Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up on the show, Morgan Spurlock, the director of the fast food documentary Supersize Me, discusses his latest project, a film about the boy band One Direction, plus a performance from the indie pop group called Pure Bathing Culture. But we begin by looking at the sacrifices we make or don't make for art and music. It's the subject of a new book from Laurie Carson, who is a singer and songwriter and one-time member of this long-running cult band, the Golden Palominos. The original 1982 is her debut novel, and in it, the main character faces a huge choice in her life, whether to become a mother. Because it's fiction, she gets to live parallel life stories. In one, she stays childless and follows a musical path. In the other, her muse is motherhood itself. It's a story that's close to the heart of Laurie Carson, who joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Laurie, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is, first of all, it's a piece of kind of alternate history. Maybe not on the grand scale of Philip K. Dick's Man in the High Castle, which, yeah. An America post-war that has lost World War II, but a very personal kind of alternate history.
Yeah.
So let me start by asking you not about anything you wrote in the book, but the little disclaimer that you find in the fine print in front of every book. Any resemblance to actual events or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental. Is that really true with this book?
It's entirely coincidental.
Your main character, Lisa Nelson.
Yes. God, her name is so similar to mine.
To Laurie Carson. Yes, yes, it is. And the quote-unquote real Lisa has foregone the opportunity to become a mom and has pursued a career in music.
Right.
And is now writing and in the act of writing, sort of creating this alternate history for herself and for her fictional daughter called Minnow.
That's right.
So, first of all, what's the meaning of the opening line of the book? You were the first little fish.
Well, I didn't know what the meaning was when I wrote that line. You know, I wrote it and it felt very alive to me.
Mm.
And the story kind of took off from there and it became her nickname and then her name.
Minnow, right. So, who wrote that line? Was that you writing as Lisa or was that you writing as Laurie Carson?
You know, when you touched on, when you said what you did about rewriting history, I mean, I think we all want to do that. And every part of the story is actually a rewrite of my own history. The musical stuff didn't happen the way it happens in the book. Obviously, I never had a child. In this story, Lisa, my alter ego, is very distraught over the fact that she has not had a child. Me, I'm more ambivalent.
Uh-huh.
So in choosing to tell this specific story, it becomes fictionalized in my mind, even if some of the things are close to my literal history.
Now, your literal history is one that is largely in the music world, a bunch of records on your own. I mentioned the Golden Palominos before.
Mm-hmm.
And when you said just a moment ago that opening line, you weren't quite sure what that meant.
Yeah.
I've heard songwriters say that,
where
a lyric comes to you and you don't know where it came from or what it means, and you kind of just have to follow it.
It's true. It feels like sort of a magical gift that is just presented to you as a riddle, but it resonates emotionally, and that's how you know it's important.
Mm.
So, as you say, you follow it. You follow the story.
So, when you wrote that line, did you know it was the beginning of a novel, or did you think, where's this song going to go?
I knew it was the beginning of a novel because I really wanted to write a novel. And I had taken a couple of writing workshops, and I was involved in a writer's group. And I didn't quite believe I could yet because I truly believed that my expertise was in the short form and in writing songs. And I am a huge fan of other novelists and fiction in general. So it was something that was a dream of mine that I didn't quite believe in, but I had made a decision that I was going to write every day for a year. And so that was the first line of that year.
The book is called The Original 1982 by Laurie Carson. And just as in the telling of the story, Lisa Nelson's fact and fiction, you know, sometimes get a little blurred. Mm-hmm. The real you and Lisa Nelson, there are moments where you sort of bleed into the story as well,
yes.
Specifically through some of the songs, and most specifically a song called Still True, which appears throughout the book.
Yes. It's kind of interesting because it's, in a way, Still True is a perfect example of the way the whole book was written, because Still True is a song that I wrote in the 80s. I really wanted it to be on my first record, Shelter, and my A&R guy said, no, I don't like the way it sounds, I don't like the way it came out, we're not including it on the record. Now, I always thought that it could be like a big song, right? But I never recorded it the way that it should have been recorded. And the only way it's ever been recorded was on like a sloppy record of demos that mm-hmm. I put out called House in the Weeds, which has this awful bridge in it. But I was able to fictionalize it in my story, and it becomes Lisa Nelson's big hit song. It's her hit record of her whole career, so it was fun to play with that.
This is the song that Laurie Carson is talking about and which kind of reappears at key moments in her new novel called The Original 1982.
Wondering if I'm ever going to see you again, and what'll I say if I do? You're the only one in my heart, it's still true.
That is my guest, Laurie Carson, the writer and songwriter, solo artist, and now novelist with her debut book, The Original 1982, following the adventures of her alter ego, not Laurie Carson, but Lisa Nelson, who is writing an alternate history of her own life and career in which she has made the choice to become a mom. And Laurie, the timing of this novel could not be better. I mean, the whole opt-out thing, and, you know, this has become a real discussion point for women. You know, is it appropriate to opt out of a career to raise a family? Can you possibly have it all? Can you do both? I mean, this is a big topic nowadays.
But don't you find that any time you have an idea, like 10,000 other people are having the same idea?
But yet these things do cohere sometimes, you know, at little points of time where there's like a big accretion of a lot of people talking about the same idea at the same time.
It's
and
true.
Right now,
this is what we're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah. Did you feel like you were sort of participating in that conversation in some way in the writing of this book?
It kind of happened after I was finished. Although I did think when I was writing it and I was addressing it to the daughter who had never been born, and I was thinking a lot about abortion during that time, which was the early 80s. And I was thinking about motherhood versus career. And I did think, oh, my God, three other people are going to write this book before I have a chance to publish it. You know, I had this sense that
there was
there
something
alive
yeah,
about it, you know.
Yeah. One of the most striking lines in this entire book, which is all about choice and regret for the choices made or the path not taken,
mm-hmm.
Comes late in the book where you're talking, where, not you, Lisa is talking, this is real Lisa, mm-hmm. without the child, in her music career. She's talking to one of her producers about, you know, why do we have the lives that we do? And he answers, it's an illusion, this idea that we can choose our lives. That sentence popped off the page, given the context of what this book is about.
Yeah.
What did, do you take that literally? Is he, are you the unreliable narrator here? Are we supposed to take that ironically? Is he being a jerk by saying that, or do you believe that?
I do believe it. I think that to a large extent, choice is an illusion because we're kind of built the way we're built. And so we naturally make choices that are probably the choices we're meant to make.
Hmm. So you chose in your own career to go for the career as opposed to raising a family.
Yeah.
And that you said before that you're not in your character's state of, like, constant regret, but somewhat more ambivalent about it.
Right.
If you had the chance to do it over again, do you think you would make the same choices?
Well, I probably would, based on what we were just talking about. However, you know, if I could somehow live two lives,
right,
as Lisa Nelson does, I would also have a child. You know, regret is so, it's such a rich thing, regret. Because, yes, I really regret not having a child. At the same time, I know it was probably the right choice for me. So
you know, exploring this sort of theme in the book, I mean, basically, this book seems to serve for you what the story within the book does for Lisa.
I think that's very well said. It's true.
I'm not quite sure what I just said there. But
maybe somebody will understand.
It really is kind of, you know, as any alternate history sort of thing is, part of it is, you know, the kind of the mind game that the author is playing with you, the reader.
Yes.
And I really enjoyed that part of this book called The Original 1982 by Laurie Carson. Your character, Lisa, is a singer-songwriter in New York, and you mention a lot of the places where I guess you really did play in the 1980s, right?
Right.
So,
yeah.
And when the real Lisa,
yes,
begins her career and starts recording albums and things like that,
yes,
she's sort of parallel to your career as a singer-songwriter, right?
Especially at the in the early sort of pages of the story. There are parallels, although I deliberately, when I thought it was getting too close, would shift dates around and things around. But there are certain descriptions that are very true to my own story, as when Lisa first plays at Gertie's Folk City during a time where it was just the place to go for open mic. And there were all these songwriters, singer-songwriters, who would come down on Monday nights, and we would play. And I mean, I went down there for a year before I had the courage to get up and play my own songs, listening, you know, and it was so big. And, you know, the guy who owned Folk City at the time, Robbie Wolliver, went on to be somebody who has helped me so many times. You know, we've just been, you know, throughout my career, he's been very important to me, and he has a little cameo in the story, and I did that with people who have, you know, who mean a lot to me. The girl who plays the background singer, I cast her as this girl I actually knew, who I don't see anymore, who I still miss. And
so,
anyway,
again,
I don't know what I'm talking about anymore.
I mean, it must be hard to keep track of fact and fiction. You got the two layers of fiction in the book and the factual overlay of, you know, your own life. And your own recordings, and Lisa's career sort of parallels yours. By the late 80s, she's beginning to make records, as you did.
Mm-hmm.
Your first album, Shelter, came out in 1990.
Right.
And included a duet with Greg Allman.
There was a duet with Greg Allman, yes. And, you know, it's a very interesting duet because he sounds like Greg Allman, and I sound like a girl who was just recently learned English.
Let's hear a little bit of that duet. It's called Imagine Love. This is from Laurie Carson's first record, Shelter, back in 1990.
When I talk about the long ago, it's you I miss.
Time softens all the blows.
that fell. Sweetens both the highs and lows till you're more like a dream than a man of wonder. Imagine love is always waiting for us where we left it hid, closed in a room with pillows thrown about it, bedding left unmade. Imagine love, imagine love lies waiting, frozen out in time.
That is my guest, Laurie Carson, and a duet with Greg Allman called Imagine Love. That's from 1990, but man, there's a lot of the lyrics there sort of are kind of prescient when you start looking at this new novel about freezing time and imagining the love of a child who isn't born. Nice work.
Thanks.
Nice work, young Laurie Carson, foreshadowing the
looking into the future.
The book is called The Original 1982. It is a novel. It is really poignant and funny and a real joy to read. And
thank
Laurie,
you.
Thank you so much for being with us on Soundcheck
today.
Thank
you so much for having me.
Coming up next, director Morgan Spurlock on his new documentary. It's about the British boy band One Direction. And later, a live set in our studio from the indie pop group called Pure Bathing Culture. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and here's a tip from me to you. Going to the movies this Friday night might be a little treacherous. That's the day that This Is Us opens nationwide. It's a new movie about the insanely popular British boy band One Direction. Expect lines, posters, and lots of screaming fans. Documentary filmmaker Morgan Spurlock knows all about those screaming fans because the creator of the Oscar-nominated 2004 film Super Size Me followed the popular group on tour as the director of this new film, This Is Us. He's on the line with us. Hi, Morgan.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So how does a guy who almost killed himself eating nothing but McDonald's end up making a One Direction film?
Yeah, you know, it was one of those opportunities when I got a call from the studio and they said, would you like to make a film with this band? And, you know, here they are, one of the biggest bands in the world. In the film, you see them explode into this massive global phenomenon. And I was like, this is just too great of an opportunity not to tell this story.
All right. And where in the story do you come in? Because for folks who don't know, One Direction was basically put together by Simon Cowell when they were all sort of individually trying out for his show, The X Factor.
That's right. And so we kind of tell that story. We tell the birth story of the band, kind of, you know, show where these kids all came from. Like, they literally just all came from the humblest of humble beginnings in small towns all across the UK. And then within 3 years have exploded into the massive juggernaut they are now.
They're massive. They're a juggernaut. But you, Morgan Spurlock, are not their target demographic, if you know what I'm saying.
I am so not their target demographic. But after seeing 35-plus One Direction concerts while making this film, I have to say that I am now officially a fan.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
So why did they reach out for you in the first place?
Well, I think, for a couple reasons. One of the things that I've always done in my films is, you know, I think we've always tried to make movies that are very broad in their appeal. You know, we try and make things that go beyond a traditional doc audience that I think, you know, reach into almost like a pop mainstream audience. And so I think the studio's thinking was, if he could do that with those other films, what if we give him one that already has a built-in audience? How can we even expand on that even further? And I think the film really accomplishes that.
All right. Well, now here's what Simon Cowell, who put One Direction together in the UK, had to say about you, Morgan Spurlock.
Well, Morgan wasn't somebody who was ever going to tell them, do this, do that. Morgan is somebody who likes to kind of eavesdrop. You know, he wants to pick stuff up without even people realizing that they're being filmed, and that's his skill. And he's very patient.
So you as fly on the wall.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of this movie. I'm not in one frame of this film, so that's the other thing. So if people have hated every other movie I've made up till now, they're going to love One Direction, This Is Us.
And what would you call it? Is it a documentary? I mean,
It's a concert. It's about the third concert and about 62 minutes, you know, all doc footage behind the scenes as we're following them around.
Right. But my understanding is you didn't have Final Cut approval, which is strikes me as really odd for a documentary.
Well, I think any time you make a movie with a studio, especially, you know, of this scope and scale, studio's going to have input. You know, there was never a time where, you know, I got pushback from anybody and was told what I had to put in the movie or what I had to take out. So from that standpoint, while on paper the studio may have, you know, ultimately had final say of what the film would ultimately be, nobody forced my hand, which is what making movies is all about.
So there's nothing left out that you were trying to keep in?
No, never. I mean, everything that we did to tell this story was ultimately the story I wanted to tell. So I felt very fortunate to have, you know, not only the studios, but, you know, I think Simon's support to make that happen.
So what's this band like to film? I mean, they seem to have a sense of humor because they have that one video for Best Song Ever.
Yeah, where they're all dressed up in costumes.
Right, they're all dressed as like studio executives saying, you got to be a boy band. Well, we don't want to be a boy band.
That's right. No, they were, these guys are a lot of fun. They have a great sense of humor. You know, they don't take themselves too seriously. And, you know, I tell people all the time that they are like the anti-boy band, boy band. You know, they don't dress in the same clothes. They don't do, you know, dance routines. You know, I think they've kind of been a bit, you know, against the grain from the beginning when it comes to what people would expect from them. And I think that's what makes them popular. I think that people like the fact that they haven't kind of bought into all that.
Well, and in this clip, we hear One Direction members Louis Tomlinson, Niall Horan, and Zayn Malik talking about boy bands.
I was never really a fan of boy bands before One Direction.
I'm a massive boy band fan myself. Backstreet Boys, NSYNC. When people say you're in a boy band, I'm like, yeah, I am, but I'm in a cool boy band. So I'm like, okay, vibes.
So they're distancing themselves from the idea of being a boy band, even as they are blowing up and becoming the biggest boy band on earth.
That's exactly right. I think it's funny. These guys are really, I think they're smart. I think they've been, one of the things that I love about them that I think really resonates with the fans is how completely normal they've been. I mean, these guys are world famous, multimillionaire pop stars now, but have literally stayed so grounded. I think a lot of that because of their families. There's great scenes in the movie with their families, so you kind of really see who they are and where they came from. But the fact that these five guys, I think, keep each other grounded and kind of keep each other in check is really important.
I would think that, you know, given what you just said, that the families would be a little leery of having, you know, a major documentary maker, you know, about to have a film open on screens around the globe.
That's right.
You know, in their homes, in their living rooms, watching them talk to little Niall or little Zayn or
Believe
whatever.
I think when we first showed up the cameras, there was a tremendous amount of trepidation. But I'm very tenacious and persistent. I don't go away easily. So I think in time.
So
I
you really are like a fly then.
I am. I wore them down. I wore them down slowly but surely. And it's one of the things with the families where, you know, I think they were more uncomfortable with us being around in the beginning. They realized kind of how great the story is. I mean, these five guys have just, you know, they've just become something truly special. And I think that, you know, for the families to want to, like, be a part of that, I thought was great.
We're speaking with Morgan Spurlock. He's the Oscar-nominated filmmaker behind Super Size Me and the greatest movie ever sold. His latest is this One Direction film called This Is Us, opening on Friday in theaters nationwide. So did you have to listen to a lot of One Direction to kind of prep for this?
I have listened to more One Direction in the past year than probably any man in his 40s ever should or will. It's one of the things where once it gets in your head, it's there forever. Like, it is, I find myself waking up, I find myself singing it when I'm, like, walking down the street, I'm in the gym. I've done such a good job of getting into the mind of, like, the fandom of the band, the Directioners, that I have not had a night's sleep where I haven't dreamt about this band in probably about 10 months.
I'm not sure how to respond to that, Morgan. I think I'm a little worried for you right now. But now, One Direction is known for having a particularly rabid fan base, most of them younger than you.
That's right.
Did you, you know, get any kind of up close and personal, you know, interactions with the fan base?
I mean, there's a lot of great fan moments in the film. You know, you see these fans who literally they come out in by the thousands wherever the boys go. Like the minute they walk out of a hotel or they get out of a car, suddenly like 50 fans becomes 500. I mean, it is incredible how these numbers just exponentially explode when the band comes around. And there are some really funny and fun fan moments that are in there from you know, fans both in Mexico City or throughout Europe or the United States. I mean, it's great.
Does it get scary at times?
I think it gets, I'm more scared for the fans than I was for us or for the boys, because, you know, what happens is when the fans see the guys, like, they'll start chasing the bus down the street. They'll be running after them. Like, they're kind of out of their head, just like trying to get a piece of them, and they're not paying attention where they're going. And so we'd be filming and we'd be shooting outside the bus, and I'm just watching these people run alongside, and I'm like, look where you're going, look where you're going.
So Morgan, I mean, you clearly you got deeply into this project over the course of, what, a year, 2 years?
Yeah, we filmed with them nonstop for 6 months.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
In your non-One Direction time,
yes.
What do you listen to?
You know, I grew up a big Metallica fan. I love Louis Armstrong. Like, I'm a huge Louis Armstrong fan. What have I been listening to? I've been, like, really digging on the Lumineers, you know, for the past few months.
Uh-huh.
Like, I love those guys, Mumford & Sons. So, I don't know. It's like, I'm pretty eclectic.
Yeah, I would say so. Metallica and One Direction on the iPod.
they're right next to one another.
Okay. The film is called This Is Us. It's Morgan Spurlock's latest, and it's about the British band One Direction. It opens on Friday, August 30th in theaters nationwide. Morgan, very nice speaking with you, and
great
good luck.
Talking to you as well. Thank you so much. Take care.
One Direction's rabid fan base recently voted this song, called Best Song Ever, as the Song of the Summer at the MTV Video Music Awards, a somewhat controversial choice, it seems, on Sunday night's broadcast. Up next, live pop here in the Soundcheck studio from the Portland band called Pure Bathing Culture. That's next. Now, tomorrow afternoon, right here at soundcheck.org, we will once again be doing a live webcast of the entire show, and our guest in the studio will be Goldspot, the New York band led by the singer-songwriter Siddhartha Khosla. You can hear them performing live as part of our 2 p.m. webcast tomorrow here at soundcheck.org. But while we get today's band, Pure Bathing Culture, set up here in the studio, let's get a sneak preview of tomorrow's group. From the new album Aerogram, here's a song called If the Hudson Overflows by Goldspot. I know it's hard enough. So that's some music from Goldspot. They will be here in the Soundcheck studio tomorrow afternoon as part of our week-long set of live webcasts between 2 and 3-ish. And we're all sitting here in the studio enjoying the sounds of Gold Spot. And by we, I mean myself and the members of Pure Bathing Culture, today's live music guests. We'll hear from them in just a moment.
The places, we will go.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and this music comes from the new album by the band Pure Bathing Culture. They may be from Portland, Oregon, but their music is full of sounds we usually associate with Southern California. Even their name suggests dreamy, bubbly pop. Pure Bathing Culture is here in the Soundcheck studio to play for us, and they'll start with a song called Dream the Dare.
See you.
Song's called Dream the Dare. You'll find it on the new album by the band Pure Bathing Culture. The record is called Moon Tides. It's out now. And the band playing live here in the Soundcheck studio. Let me introduce you to Pure Bathing Culture. Dan Hindman on guitar. Sarah Versprill playing keyboards and singing. Zach Tillman on bass. Brian Wright behind the drums. And while this is the first time that Pure Bathing Culture has been on Soundcheck, Sarah, for you and Dan, it's a return visit.
It is, yeah.
You guys were here with Vetiver a couple of years back.
Yeah.
Now, the album you were doing then, I mean, Vetiver was known as a folk, or more specifically, a psychedelic folk band, but that was a pop, more pop-leaning record.
So that was for Aaron Charm?
Hmm?
Was that for the Aaron,
Aaron Charms, yeah. Yes. So, you know, it's were you already headed in this direction, or did that album kind of steer you guys in the direction of what is now Pure Bathing Culture?
Yeah, I think everything we did with Vetiver was influencing us, you know. I don't know if it, like, steered us in this direction, mm-hmm. But that's hard. I hear, because there is a lot of, like, textures on that record. But at the same time, I would be the first person to admit that I wasn't really responsible for the conception of those textures. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's interesting thinking about it like that. I guess we were influenced in that way. I mean, I was participated in playing them, a lot of, like, the Volume Swell stuff. And
right, because,
you know,
and especially, Dan, your participation in that record, a lot of it was not recognizable as electric guitar. It was really atmospheric stuff that you were doing.
There was a lot of that, yeah.
Right, which is a big part of the sound of this band now as well.
Definitely.
What about the name Pure Bathing Culture? I mean, in our culture, nothing is pure. Everything is all mixed up. Are we meant to take that ironically?
No.
Not at all.
No. I think more things should be pure. I mean, I'm sure we'll be criticized for, you know, having our hearts too much on our sleeves, but, you know, we believe in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is not your first record. This is the second record as Pure Bathing
this
Culture.
This is our first full-length.
Full-length,
we had
right?
a four-song EP.
And have people leveled that accusation at you, that you're wearing your hearts on your sleeves?
Man, people, we've been really lucky. People have said everything, good and bad, at this point in time. So it's...
Yeah, it's been interesting reading what everyone has to say.
Well, this album, Moontides, I mean, the title of the album itself suggests that this might be a little darker, a little more nocturnal or dreamy than that first set of EP songs. Do you hear it that way?
Yeah, I think we do. I think everything that we've been through in the last couple of years with just starting this band and the process, there's been so much joy in it, and also so much crazy energy happening. And I think that this record is definitely just sort of like a culmination of all of that experience over the years.
Mm-hmm. I'm probably not the first person to tell you this, but there are parts of this record that remind me of the Cocteau Twins from the 80s. You know, mm-hmm. Your voice, Sarah, is very much awash in reverb, bathing, maybe I should say, in
sure.
reverb, and kind of, you know, mixed down with the rest of the instruments, mm-hmm. the way the Cocteau Twins did with Elizabeth Fraser's voice back in the 80s. When you got into the studio with Richard Swift, who's worked with The Shins and Foxygen and all these other bands, what was the idea? Did you have something where you said to him, "This is what we want"?
Yeah, we had the songs and the basic building blocks of the sound of the band really, really together. You know, in terms of the way the guitars sounded and sort of Sarah's vocal concept and the songs, which for this record were really still very, very simplistic songs. You know, we basically just recorded the record really fast. I mean, mm-hmm. Richard has a way of, as a certain sound that he gets as an engineer, really awesome vibey sound. And we basically recorded like a song a day for about 10 days, and then we were done.
And the result is this new record called Moontides from the band Pure Bathing Culture. They're playing tonight at Glasslands Gallery at 11 p.m. Yeah. And playing for us here live on Soundcheck today. You want to do Pendulum next?
Yes.
All right. Once again, it's Pure Bathing Culture live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Once again, live music from the band Pure Bathing Culture here in the Soundcheck studio. That's their song Pendulum. It's on their new album called Moontides, which is out now. They're playing at Glasslands Gallery in Brooklyn tonight, 11 p.m., and playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio. Up next is another song. This one is called Twins. Once again, this is Pure Bathing Culture live on Soundcheck. Thank you. That's called Twins from the band Pure Bathing Culture, live in the Soundcheck studio. The new album's called Moontides. It is out now. Dan Hindman on guitar, Sarah Versprill playing keyboards and singing, Zach Tillman on bass, Brian Wright on drums. And Sarah, I mentioned before the British band Cocteau Twins, mm-hmm. but a lot of other critics have been mentioning California bands, from the Laurel Canyon folks to people like Don Henley and stuff. And you guys recently recorded a version of the Fleetwood Mac song Dreams.
Yeah.
So is that, are you kind of planting your flag and saying, yes, this is this is an influence, an inspiration?
Well, for sure Fleetwood Mac is an inspiration and an influence on us. But for as far as Dreams go, we were super lucky to be asked to record the song for a comp that Mojo Magazine put out. When they asked us to do it, we didn't know what song they were going to say, ask us to do, and we found out it was going to be that one, and we were just so excited. It's one of the greatest songs.
We're actually going to hear a little bit of your version of the Fleetwood Mac song Dreams to wrap things up. Dan, Sarah, Brian, and Zach, thank you guys so much for coming in and playing for us today.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks for having us, John.
The band is Pure Bathing Culture, and this is Soundcheck. Remember, you can listen to tomorrow's show live, including more music and conversation, plus the occasional blooper. Stream us live, online, 2 p.m. all this week on soundcheck.org. That's also where you can find out more about New York musician Marco Benevento, who composed the Soundcheck theme song called Eagle Rock. I'm told it's big in Japan. See you back here tomorrow. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.